Welcome to Resurrection Recovery, a ministry of hope and healing provided by Church of the Resurrection. This podcast is produced by Resurrection Recovery participants as a way to share their experience, strength, and hope as they move through the recovery journey. You can join us every Thursday night at 6 p.m. for a community meal and a personal story, and then support groups at 7 p.m. Check our website at core.org/recovery for special events, location, and a group that might fit your need.
And she is going to share her experience, strength, and hope with us tonight. So let's welcome Brooke. Oh, and this is Finley. She's our therapy dog in training. So by the way, welcome.
She's going to help out.
She's going to help out.
Yeah. This is awesome. Do you need me on this?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for being here tonight. My name is Brooke Wesley, and can you hear me? All right. I am a therapist over at Bellator Recovery, but have also been in recovery now from anorexia nervosa for about 22 years. So I'm going to share my story with you and then talk to you a little bit about what healing from this disease has looked like over the course of the last 22 years. I'm going to start from the time that I was very little. I think that with most of these diseases, we can see oftentimes growth within us. So from the time that I was very, very little, I was born a really anxious child. I never really believed that, but some of the behaviors that I engaged in certainly led everybody else to believe that. From the time I was about 6 months old, I would make myself pass out if I didn't get what I wanted. So for months, my mom would rush me back into the pediatrician, terrified that there was something horribly wrong with me, and each time he would tell her that I was just throwing a temper tantrum. She absolutely did not believe him. So this went on for about a year. She'd rush me back in, something's wrong with her, test her heart, test her brain, test everything. Nothing was wrong with me. He would tell her again that I was having a temper tantrum, and he challenged her to let me wake up with nobody around me. So the next time I passed out was in the middle of Independence Center at a tuxedo store. I was throwing a temper tantrum about something. I was 18 months old, and they scattered. I hit the ground, and when I woke up, nobody was around, and I never passed out again. So really validating the fact that I was just throwing a temper tantrum. Beyond that, my mom would tell you that I was super kind of precocious. I was a big rule follower. I was constantly correcting manners, telling people what they were doing wrong. At the age of three, there was a woman who was telling my aunt how adorable I was at an airport restaurant, and I told her that it was impolite to chew with her mouth full. Don't know that she thought I was so cute after that. Moving up the scale, by the time I was about 7 or 8, I developed a massive phobia of vomiting. There are lots of people that have this phobia. I thought I was a total freak, as did my mom at the time, but emetophobia is actually ranks pretty high up there. So I was terrified of throwing up. I was so terrified of throwing up that I would not go to sleep at night. My parents took me to a therapist. I was 8 years old. His name was Rory Grounds. I remember him very clearly. And he started working on some behavior modification techniques with me. And then every time somebody coughed or got sick or said they didn't feel well, I would bolt out of the house in the middle of the night. So my parents would have to come find me instead of tend to the sibling that was sick. There were four of us, four kids in my household. They would chase me down. I would end up in trouble, grounded, which was fine with me because I wasn't planning on leaving my room until everybody was well and on the mend anyways. I was so scared, my phobia was so intense, that I would stay in my room as long as I thought anybody was sick, despite what my family told me. I would cover my mouth, run in through a different way to the kitchen to get some water, and run back to my room without letting my breath go, thinking that I would potentially get sick. They moved on with some meditation stuff, trying to do some hypnotism, trying to kind of figure out how to move through this anxiety. I continued to escalate for probably 3 years. Eventually, my therapist told my parents that they just probably needed to spank me. So, Brooke, if you get out of bed tonight, if you choose not to go to sleep, if we're having this temper tantrum of anxiety, we're gonna have to spank you. I don't remember them ever spanking me. I do, however, remember not getting out of bed and going to them, but getting out of bed and going and sitting on the toilet, because certainly I could not get spanked for sitting on the toilet. So I would sit in the bathroom and I would cry a prayer. I would pray to God that he would please let my mom and dad hear me and know how scared I was and that they needed to come to me. And eventually they would, and they would take me back to bed and tuck me in, and eventually I would probably fall asleep. I would not get in my bed until I said my prayers in the exact same way, and I was convinced that if I said them in a different way, that somebody was going to wake up and be sick in the middle of the night. Moving forward, my therapist fired me. He told my parents that I potentially was going to be the first female president of the United States, and that he couldn't do anything else for us. So I was fired. I was 9, 10, could not go back to him, which rightfully so. I would probably do the same thing now in my practice. Fast forward just a few years, I played sports. I was in softball. I was in baseball or basketball. My brothers and sisters all were too. Parents were married. From the outside in, we had a Leave It to Beaver family, which begs the question as to how this disease developed in the treatment world. We talk a lot about genetics loading the gun and life pulling the trigger. I began to have pretty disrupted body image around the age of 12. At 12, I was body checking a lot. I really wanted to look different. I was a softball catcher. I lifted a lot of weights. I played pretty intensely. I played at a competitive level and started to get interested in boys, didn't want to look like an athlete. I wanted to look like some of the other girls at school. So I started changing the way that I was working out, and didn't come after that for another couple of years. About the age of 14, boys started to come around. They started to notice me. They would always talk about how much stronger I was than them, how much bigger I was than them, which was not a great feeling as a 14-year-old girl. So I again started trying to work out a little bit more. In my health class that year, it was my freshman year in high school, my health class, they played a movie trying to help us understand what eating disorders were. This movie was called The Best Little Girl in the World. I remember it clear as day. And with this movie, I learned what it meant to be anorexic. Now, I likely would have figured it out anyways. I was kind of walking down the path. I learned a lot of tricks, and as a result of that, started implementing them very quickly. I started restricting my intake. I was abusing laxatives at a significant level, really doing things that did not align with my values at all. I was such a rule follower. Again, I reprimanded a lady at the age of 3. I was terrified to get in trouble. I told on everybody else all the time. I didn't want to break the rules. And in the middle of my eating disorder, I found myself stealing from grocery stores daily, sometimes twice a day, to get laxatives because they were expensive. I did not have the money for them, and my parents certainly were not going to buy them for me. I had tons of tricks to get around eating with my family, and my weight started to drop. I was in PE. I was 15 years old. Actually, it was a week before my 15th birthday. And some of my friends asked me for gum. I had a bunch of gum in my purse, and I told them to go ahead and get it themselves, which is kind of interesting. I knew I had a bunch of laxatives in my purse. Told them to go ahead and get it themselves. They got worried, told every teacher, I think, in the school. My mom got about 16 phone calls that day. I got home from school, ran straight to the bathroom, and she had my purse dumped out when I came out of the bathroom. She was crying, and she told me that she needed to get me some help, and I was admitted to an eating disorder treatment facility actually the next day. It was very quick. Nothing happens that fast these days, but it was really quick. So I went into, it was Baptist Medical Center at the time, And there were only two other patients there. They both struggled with eating disorders that were entirely different than mine. There was one person who had diabetes and struggled with what is now called diabulimia. And there was another person who struggled with bulimia. I was only in for about 2 weeks. I was probably one of the most dishonest patients they had ever had. I used every trick. I made it appear that I was doing everything that they were asking me to do, and I was in fact doing just about nothing that they were asking me to do. There wasn't a lot of information about eating disorders when I was 15. I am 43 now. So they sent me home. That felt like I had eaten and I hadn't taken any laxatives and I was good to go. So I go home. I was home for about 2 weeks and completely spiraled, ended up readmitted 2 weeks later. There was a whole new group of people in there, men and women, with every kind of eating disorder that you can imagine. And I really liked this group a lot. We talked a lot. We talked a lot about our behaviors. I, of course, learned a lot about new behaviors, which, again, where there's a will, there's a way. There's no blame. That happens still today, all of the time in treatment centers. I just wasn't ready to get well yet. One of the things that my parents knew at that time that we now use as standard practice was that they would say stuff to me like, you are welcome in our household and this disease is not. And so I went home, I got discharged after 2 weeks, my insurance cut out, and I was still really, really sick. They chose not to send me back to school. My grandparents were flown in to stay with me at the house so my parents could continue to work. They were spending tons of money on my treatment. And again, insurance had cut out. I continued to spiral. I continued to sneak out of the house and manipulate what I was eating. I was very, very, very starved. About 3 months later, I ended up in ICU. My dad had carried me in. Actually, it was my sister's birthday in July. My dad had carried me into the ER. My heart rate was very, very low. All of my hair had almost fallen out. I was horribly frail, and they didn't know what to do. We had medical insurance, but we had no more psychiatric benefits, so no place would admit me. So they essentially held me in a medical facility for about 2 weeks to try and stabilize heart rate and labs. At that point in time, my family had put together my treatment plan. Essentially, I had to either sit in my bedroom with a nurse or sit at the nurse's station with the nurses all day long, every day, with my IV and my food, really working on refeeding there. At that point, my mom had reached out to just about everybody in the Kansas City area, and there was a new treatment center. It was actually a substance abuse treatment facility called Cedar Ridge. And they were new in Kansas City. They did not have an eating disorder program. They wanted to treat me kind of as a trial. And what was going to happen is if I got well, then I could be their spokesperson and I would be able to kind of help them promote their eating disorder treatment. My parents were all about it. I went there. I was there for about 6 months. Interestingly, they knew nothing about eating disorder treatment. There was nobody there who specialized. There was no real protocol at that point in time. So I was treated just like I was addicted to anything else. And I will tell you that I think that was actually very, very helpful to me. When I was being treated with my eating disorder, when I would return to school or when I would go home, people would kind of treat me like I had pneumonia or strep throat, like you were sick and you went to the hospital and you're home now and you're better. But this disease is still so loud in my brain. So I would go into hiding again and spiral. When I was at Cedar Ridge and I was going through a 12-step program and learning the Serenity Prayer and like rigorous honesty and total powerlessness, it occurred to me that what was going on with me is not different than what's going on with anybody else. My maladaptive behavior was different. And it was at that point in time, I still tried to manipulate the system. I ended up in an all-glass room with 24-hour supervision because I got caught doing something in my bathroom. So I was still trying to manipulate the system. The disease was still very, very big. And again, we don't know at that time what we now know. So I was in an all-glass room. I had no privacy, 24-hour supervision for roughly 6 months. I was not allowed to lose a fourth of a pound. I went home for a weekend on a weekend pass, and if I was successful on that weekend pass, I was going to get to go home. And I went back, and I think my weight was maybe down a fourth of a pound, exactly. And I was readmitted for 2 weeks. So again, what I thought was horrible and like they were abandoning me and nobody loved me was really them saying, we are absolutely not negotiating with this disease. So I was back in for another 2 weeks, then discharged again back to home. At that point in time, again, there wasn't a lot out there for eating disorders. I continued to follow up with, I only had one treater, it was a psychiatrist. He also did my therapy, so med prescription and therapy, and kind of my dietitian too. He had food in his office and he would always tell me what to eat. Was an amazing, amazing man. And I saw him for really about the next 6 or 7 years. He walked through all of my high school relationships with me. He walked through getting into college and terrible fears and perfectionism and people pleasing, and he taught me how to set boundaries. And I met my husband when I was about 22, and that's about the time I stopped seeing him. I met my husband, I graduated from college, and we were moving into our first house. I might have been turning 23 at the time, and I relapsed pretty severely. One of the things that I had not learned in my recovery was that this disease, and I think in pictures, and everybody I treat knows that, but kind of likes to sneak in when there is any intense emotion, not just distressing emotion. So all these really awesome things were happening in my life, and I tanked quickly. And I had no idea that I tanked because I was a very good patient and I didn't have a scale and I wasn't managing or weighing anything. So I thought I was doing fine. I was training for a triathlon and I wasn't doing fine. I did not return to treatment at that time. I did go back on medication. So I started myself back on medication and really worked a lot on my relationship with my higher power. When I was at Cedar Ridge, I was 15 and 16, and of course I thought everything everybody was telling me was ridiculous. But there was one psych tech there, her name was Tracy, and she would always tell me that she doesn't care what I thought was bigger than me, but I needed to know that something was bigger than me. And knowing that something was bigger than me in the universe is what was actually going to help me heal. And for her, she said it was the toilet. She said she didn't know anything about God or any other higher power, but what she knew is that the toilet was gonna be there. It was gonna be there every single time she went into any bathroom. And so she was just hoping to be sober until the next time she went to the bathroom. And I remembered that, and so I started journaling, and my journal was a journal to God. I would write to him every morning, and then when I would get home from work, school, whatever I was doing, I would try and take a few minutes to listen, and then I would respond as if he was talking back to me. I remember days of being on my knees in tears, feeling like I was never, ever, ever going to be better. The path that anybody with an eating disorder has to follow to be well is much like the path of anybody with any other maladaptive disorder. I had to learn how to develop healthy relationships. It is not my job to take care of everybody else's emotions. So people pleasing, which is something that I'm really, really good at, actually ultimately would end up getting me in more trouble. Would end up in more disrupted relationships and kind of more compromised positions because now I'm hanging out with you and I don't even like you and I feel like I'm taking care of you and I can't get away. And so I really had to learn how to develop pretty strong boundaries in relationships, how to notice red flags when I was stepping into an abusive relationship. You know, I talked just a little bit earlier about my family, and something that's pretty hard in my own recovery, and often in people who, like my family, they were great. I really struggled with a lot of guilt and shame because they took really good care of me and they cared a lot about me. One of the things we didn't learn how to do in my household was feel. Everybody was happy all of the time. I never ever saw my parents fight. Actually, I did when I was 15, and I'm fairly confident they were probably fighting around my treatment. and I thought they were getting divorced. Like, they're in conflict, life is over as we know it. I had never seen conflict and resolution. I never saw my parents cry, ever. I still, to this day, don't know that I can tell you more than a couple of times, and only as we have started to lose people or I was in treatment. So everybody in my household was happy all the time, which makes sense when we look at that increase in distress in my own world, whether it's being excited and being married to an awesome guy or not getting a job I wanted, or putting a ton of pressure on myself to get perfect grades, whether it was this perfectionism distress, whether it's disappointment or rejection, or intense excitement, the same behavior came to attack me. Now, at the age of 43, so roughly 20 years later, I have been behavior free. I have 3 babies, I'm married, and own a treatment center. The things that I learned along the way in my recovery, how to build healthy relationships, how to be vulnerable and talk about what we're needing, how to truly say, man, I am not in a good place. Whether it's because we're in the middle of an addiction or because we're well and things are hard, things get really hard. To learn how to communicate our needs, to learn how to establish boundaries, to learn how to be rigorously honest, regardless, to learn how to stay in relationship, whether it's in relationship with your loved ones, relationship with your higher power, relationship with yourself, relationship with your treatment community. It is so insanely important. And for me, I believe that I lived it first, and then it took me a long time to learn it. And then teaching it really solidified my recovery. When I started speaking publicly, I was only 16. Again, eating disorders weren't super common. So when I got back to school, all of the high schools around my town in Blue Springs, Lee Summit, Raytown, wanted me to come talk to their health classes. And so initially I was really, really hesitant. I talked to a woman that I was in treatment with. She lived down in Mississippi and she's kind of mean. She told me, I said, I want to do all these things. I don't want to eat my dinner. I want to take laxatives. I'm so nervous to go talk to this group of kids tomorrow. And she said, well, if you do that, then you need to go and look them all in the eye and tell them what you did and that you're not equipped to talk to them. And I thought she was the biggest jerk. It's like, what the heck? But today, I know that she was preaching rigorous honesty. You can, if you're still sick, you're still sick, and we're not gonna shame that, but don't go talk to people and tell them you're well. So I did not engage in behaviors, and I did go talk to that group. And for a while, I really believed that not, again, the rule follower in me. I didn't wanna be a hypocrite. I didn't wanna talk about being well and not be well. So that's what I did. I took every speaking engagement that came my way and really talked about recovery from an eating disorder perspective. You know, we have to learn how to balance our addiction, and it takes a really long time. It's a long, long path of slips and slides and picking ourselves back up, or having our families pick us back up, or our friends. You know, we may be doing really, really well for 3 months, and then slip and engage in some sort of binge behavior or purge behavior or laxatives or restriction or overexercise, and or just know that we talk a lot about negotiating with the disease, like it just kind of whispers in your ear, and maybe it's just a little something, maybe it's not huge, but that little something leads to a very, very, very slippery slope, and it is so easy to fall down. So it takes a long time. There are lots and lots of hills and valleys. And the goal in eating disorder treatment, much like any other treatment, is for those hills and valleys to just get smaller and smaller and smaller until it kind of turns into a much more flat field that still has some pretty darn big obstacles, because those come our way either way. So that is my story. That's my story in a very, very condensed version. Do you guys have any questions at all? No? Yes?
Has anyone ever suggested emotional intensity? Like, you talk about even the good times make you crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean crazy.
Yeah, really triggered, right? I mean, right. At that time, yeah.
So have you heard that phrase when it comes to
emotional intensity?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So you're the first person I've ever heard that I made it sound normal.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard.
I mean, we are okay with the status quo. The hills and valleys, they can really throw us for a loop when we're struggling with balance and addiction, for sure. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're so welcome. Anybody else? Yes. Yeah. So there are so many different types of eating disorders. So I am going to give a couple of different kind of symptoms that you would potentially look at. A lot of times people with eating disorders, can I give a couple of kind of signs or symptoms that one might notice with somebody with an eating disorder? A lot of times it's picking or pushing food around the plate. Sometimes it's eating really, really fast. Sometimes it's kind of excuses to not really eat at all. You know, sometimes people who are struggling really don't want to eat around other people or be seen eating around other people. Sometimes it's picking things apart. Sometimes it's very ritualistic. And, you know, the interesting thing is that a lot of times the behaviors that we would qualify as eating disorder behaviors don't happen as much around food at all. I mean, sometimes it's laxative use, sometimes it's purging afterwards, sometimes it's, stuff you wouldn't see. Sometimes it's like horrendous fear of going into a grocery store or ordering a meal at a restaurant. Sometimes it's overexercising, sometimes it's complete isolation. But as far as meals go, very ritualistic, breaking things down, pushing things around, always having an excuse to not be there or show up, or maybe they've already eaten or they have plans to eat later. So lots of avoidance. Yeah. Anything else? Yes. Yeah.
Eating disorders,
yes.
That are recognized now that people seek treatment for.
Yes.
Just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what those are.
And actually, some of them are much more prevalent than anorexia and bulimia. So binge eating disorder is really the most common eating disorder, and sadly isn't recognized nearly as much. But the devastation, the medical complications, the emotional complications are just as big. So binge eating disorder, diabulimia, there are also eating disorders around clean eating and overexercising. What am I missing? That's orthorexia, anorexia, bulimia, diabulimia, binge eating disorder, compulsive overeating. There's also ARFID, which is called, it's avoidant food restrictive disorder. So really, really kind of texture based. So a lot of times people with ARFID will only eat stuff like pizza and chicken nuggets. They don't want anything that's soft or squishy or has a texture that maybe would be uncomfortable. And so we have to do a lot of exposure therapies with that. Yes, actually, we have before, and we would love to do it again. But we did a big training a few years ago at JUCO for the teachers and nurses in the schools.
So it seems like that would be a key.
Yeah.
That's something we need to do here.
We would love to. We would love to. Yeah. Yes.
So when you're going through a hard time with your eating disorder, what is it that friends, family can do?
Yeah, a lot of times it's just being available. We talk a lot about just holding space. We tend to really want to fix people that we care about, and the eating disorder, like any other addiction or illness, is not super fixable. And so really just holding space. The things that we don't want to do is comment on somebody's body size or tell them, you know, they need to eat more, or they haven't eaten enough, whatever. We just want to really hold space. A lot of times, one of the things that my dad would do with me all of the time is if he saw me getting anxious just by my facials or leg shaking or picking my fingers, he would just put his arm on me and take me for a walk. He would just say, "Why don't we just go for a walk?" And we would just head on out. And that was really enough. Yeah. I think, are you trying to dismiss? Because I can stay up here and answer questions if you need to dismiss.
It's time for break out the groups, but I would say if people have questions and you can hang around, right?
Yeah, I'm good.
Are you leading a group tonight or somebody else?
I am, but I can hang out.
Yeah, so why don't we go ahead and break, regroup, and people that have questions for Brooke, hang out, and thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. If you would like more information about this ministry or Church of the Resurrection, visit our website at core.org/recovery, where you can find a listing of support groups that meet every Thursday. If you would like more immediate attention, our congregational care ministries have several support options such as prayer requests, counseling, etc. at core.org/care. Thank you for listening today.